Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine, the September 30th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And this week we're going to start with The Dawn of Superstorms by Porter Fox. Earlier this summer, Hurricane Beryl broke virtually every early season hurricane record. It was the earliest Category 5 storm in history, and the strongest July Atlantic hurricane with winds of 165 miles an hour. As ocean and air temperatures spike, extreme weather is growing more intense than ever before. This is the dawn of the superstorm era, and will only continue to rise unless we take action to stop it. More Category 4 and 5 hurricanes hit the United States mainland from 2017 to 2021, than from 1963 to 2016. Hurricanes today are lasting longer than they once did and move slower, multiplying the damage. Rapid intensification used to spin up once a century, but studies show that in the future it could occur more frequently, especially in waters bordering the East Coast, putting cities like New Orleans, Houston, Tampa, and Charleston, South Carolina at a higher risk. By the year 2100, the number of major hurricanes, including a new breed of ultra-intense Category 5 storms with winds of at least 190 miles an hour, is expected to increase by 20%. As with most anthropogenic catastrophes, the effects of climate change are compounding. Storm surge now rides on an elevated sea level, flooding coastlines with walls of water more than 25 feet. Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was one of those. Because the atmosphere holds around 8% more water for every 2 degree Fahrenheit of warming, storms today carry vastly more precipitation, dumping up to 40 inches of rain in a day. Hurricane Harvey, 2017. One example of how the compounding forces of climate change are overwhelming the coastlines, according to climate scientist Kerry Emanuel, if Superstorm Sandy had occurred in 1912 instead of 2012, it might not have flooded Lower Manhattan. Over the past 50 years, tropical cyclones have also taken nearly 800,000 lives worldwide and inflicted $1.5 trillion in damages. At risk on the U.S. mainland are 44 million coastal residents from Texas to Maine, a dozen major seaside cities, thousands of coastal towns, half the nation's oil refining businesses, and major infrastructure like highways, airport, trains, and much of the shipping industry. By the end of the century, they will likely set the United States back $200 billion annually. In fact, plotting the cost of a weather disaster since 1980 follows a trajectory eerily similar to that of CO2 content in the atmosphere. 2022 was the third hottest U.S. summer in more than a century, in a year that saw 15 weather disasters cost more than $1 billion each. And 2023 shattered that record, going down as the hottest summer in modern history. As of August 8th, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or the NOAA, has reported 19 confirmed billion-dollar disaster events in the United States. Adding an estimated 0.07 watts of heat to every square meter of land and water on the planet influences pretty much everything in the ocean and the sky, including thunderstorms, blizzards, squalls, nor'easters, tornadoes, heat waves, and droughts. Hiro Murakami, a project scientist at the NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, New Jersey, worries that regions with little to no experience with extreme weather are being drawn into the storm country. A 2021 study by Yale University researchers showed that warmer waters will soon draw hurricanes north, inundating cities like Washington, New York, and Boston. A possible westward migration of the North Atlantic Tropical Cyclone Generation Zone could also result in an uptick of landfalls along the U.S. East Coast later this century. A recent study by Brooklyn's First Street Foundation also shows how hurricanes will penetrate farther inland in the decades to come, affecting U.S. states as far west as New Mexico, Kansas, and Wisconsin. Millions throughout the United States remain unprotected. Flood insurance is optional in most U.S. states. Some federal emergency management agency loans are contingent on good credit. Corrupt contractors flood to disasters because consumer protection laws do not rein them in, and state governments often lack the funds and the staffing to manage recovery. This kind of unprecedented location may be much more high risk, says Murakami. They have no dikes, no defenses. There is an option, though, Murakami says. If we stopped burning fossil fuels today, additional warming would begin to flatten almost immediately, as would the escalation of tropical cyclone intensity. Worldwide disaster is by no means predestined in any way. Not in hurricane country, typhoon country, the Horn of Africa, the Philippines, the U.S. East Coast, or the windswept island nations of the Pacific Basin. As we can see in the data, the science, and now in our own backyards, it is merely the result of inaction. Now we have the risk report by Ian Bremmer, overturning the cradle of the Arab Spring. The fruit vendor Mohamed Bouzazi's self-immolation 14 years ago inspired Tunisians to topple their longtime dictator and kicked off the 2011 Arab Spring. Of all the countries in the region that caught the revolutionary bug, Tunisia was the only one that managed to build a multi-party democracy with separation of powers and freedom of expression, for a while becoming the poster child of a successful democratization. Then came President Kais Saied, an uncharismatic constitutional lawyer who was elected in 2019 on a populist anti-corruption platform that played to Tunisians' post-revolutionary disillusionment with political gridlock and economic stagnation. 5 years later, the birthplace of the Arab Spring has become the scene of alarming democratic backsliding. The first major sign of trouble was in 2021 when Saied used the COVID-19 pandemic to centralize his power. The Tunisian president suspended the constitution, fired his prime minister, and invoked emergency protocols to govern by decree. In 2022, he went further still, dissolving parliament and rewriting the constitution. The persecution of opposition politicians, critics, activists, journalists, and union leaders has only increased since. Leaders of the Republican Union Party, the president of the Free Desturian Party, and the leader of the main opposition Ennahda Party are all behind bars on trumped-up charges. With Saied's term set to expire on October 23rd, Tunisia's strongman is seeking 5 more years as president in new elections that he scheduled for October 6th. But having spent his entire tenure dismantling the democratic checks and balances, consolidating power, and muzzling dissent, this contest will be neither free nor fair. All credible would-be challengers to Saied have been imprisoned, scared into exile, or excluded from running. On September 2nd, Tunisia's supposedly independent electoral commission, whose 7 members were appointed by the president, approved just 2 relatively unknown candidates, in defiance of an order by the country's highest court to allow 3 additional candidates to run. One of them, Ayachi Zamel, has since been arrested and charged with falsifying ballot signatures. It's unclear as to whether he will be allowed to run. Despite some public concern about Saied's autocratic drift, he remains relatively popular. His xenophobic and anti-establishment rhetoric resonates strongly with a large segment of the population that believes democracy did little to improve their living standards. Saied's biggest vulnerability comes from the worsening socioeconomic conditions that most Tunisians have experienced under his rule. After all, the one thing people dislike more than a dictator is a dictator who fails to deliver the goods. While Saeed has so far managed to stave off a sovereign default on Tunisia's bloated foreign debt without resorting to a maligned but much-needed IMF loan, this has come at the cost of higher inflation, slower economic growth, and frequent food and fuel shortages. The government is also increasingly resorting to borrowing from the once independent central bank, as well as the local banks, to cover its growing financial needs, which will further drive up inflation and create financial risks. As economic challenges deepen, citizens' trust in their government will falter. Demands for change will build. Protests and repression may follow. Perhaps there will even be calls for new elections. But Tunisians will have little recourse after Saeed's near certain and certainly illegitimate re-election this October entrenches Tunisia's autocracy and marks the definitive end of the Arab Spring's last surviving democratic experiment. Now let's head over to The Brief, How Time Ranked the World's Best Companies by Elena Semuels. There was a moment in the early days of the pandemic when employers cared deeply about keeping workers happy. That moment passed for many companies. Once quarantine ebbed and pressures from investors made them refocus on the bottom lines. But companies like Apple, Microsoft, and BMW still appear to be investing in their workers' happiness, a trait that has put them at the top of the list of a new statistical ranking of 1,000 of the world's best companies by Statista and Time magazine. The ranking is based on a formula of employee satisfaction surveys, revenue growth, and environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG, data. Microsoft, for instance, which came in third in the rankings, was the second highest rated company in employer satisfaction, after Alphabet, the parent company of Google. Microsoft has said it tries to ensure that employees are thriving, which it defines as energized and empowered to do so with meaningful work, an approach that seems to be both working at keeping employees happy and at powering revenue. The company made $88 billion in the latest fiscal year, up 22% from the prior year, and ranked highly in revenue growth. Apple also earned strong marks from employees, coming in fourth in employee satisfaction, but was propelled to the top of the rankings by its ESG rating, which was first out of all companies. The tech giant has committed to being carbon neutral by the year 2030 and is making more products with recycled materials. In early 2024, it also became the first big tech company to achieve gender equality on its board of directors, now composed of 4 men and 4 women. No one sector has dominated. Though tech companies accounted for 6 of the top 20 positions and 4 of the top 10, a German automaker, BMW Group, ranked 4th. And Accenture, the consulting firm based in Dublin, finished 2nd overall by scoring well in all 3 categories. Its CEO, Julie Sweet, was on the Time 100 list for 2024. Under her, Accenture had a deeply positive societal impact, using technology to solve pressing issues. Klaus Schwab, the founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, wrote that about Sweet. Many of the top companies have made similar positive societal impacts while making money and keeping their employees happy at the same time. It's not necessarily something that their investors are clamoring for. That they do it anyway is what sets them apart. For the full list, you can go to time.com/worlds-best-companies. And quickly, I can go through the top 20 here. Apple, Accenture, Microsoft, BMW Group, number 5 is Amazon, Electric de Paris is 6, American Express, 7, Meta Platforms, 8, Siemens, 9, JP Morgan Chase is 10. Rounding out the top 20 is Booking Holdings, Indentex, L'Oreal, Oracle, General Motors is 15, followed by Ford, Cardinal Health, Lululemon, Cisco Systems, and number 20 is Nike. Next, we have five metrics you should know about your health. And this is by Angela Haupt. If you're asked to share a few fun facts about yourself, you're probably not going to rattle off your blood pressure or your cholesterol levels, even if your good cholesterol is, well, really good. But you should have a solid sense of what those numbers are, according to the experts. Why? The old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is absolutely correct, says Josh Septimus, an internal medicine physician with Houston Methodist Hospital. A small number of conditions, including heart disease and metabolic disorders, causing an enormous amount of suffering. If we can identify a few things that help us prevent those morbidities, it's very much worth your time. You don't have to know everything. Experts widely pan full-body health scans, for example. They claim to catch early signs of problems like cancer. Septimus also steers patients away from the VO2 max test, which measures aerobic fitness levels. It's a huge ordeal. They put you on a treadmill, they mask over you to measure how much oxygen and carbon you produce while you're exercising. While the results can benefit elite athletes, they're not necessary for the average person. Likewise, while it's certainly possible to track and analyze your health data via the smartwatch, you're not necessarily going to gain much by doing so. When Septimus's patients get lost in some random number or ask about a test with little return, he refocuses them on the basics. Here's a look at the five metrics everyone should know about their own health. Number one, waist circumference. Septimus likes to say that if he could use only one measurement to predict how much a person would suffer from medical problems, it would be waist circumference, which reveals the amount of fat around your midsection. If you have a waist size greater than 35 inches for women or 40 inches for men, your risk for heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and any other metabolic problem will increase. To figure out your waist circumference, stand up, exhale, and wrap a tape around your belly button. If your number is over the threshold, talk to your doctor about the healthiest way forward. Number 2. Cholesterol profile. You should always have a sense of your total cholesterol. The high-density lipoprotein, or HDL cholesterol, and especially the low-density lipoprotein, the LDL cholesterol. The last one is going to tell me about the patient's risk of developing coronary disease or arterial sclerosis, also known as the plaque-clogged arteries, says Dr. Sam Serata, a cardiologist at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. He runs lipid panels on his patients at least annually. Not every doctor does, so you may need to ask for a panel if it has been a while. Number 3. Your blood pressure. If you have high blood pressure, your heart has to work harder to pump the blood, which can damage the walls of the blood vessels, leading to arterial sclerosis. Hypertension can trigger complications like heart attack and stroke, while hurting the organs, including your brain and your kidneys. That's why it's so important to check your blood pressure at least once a year, and more often if you're at a higher risk based on factors like age, family history, and obesity. We have dozens of blood pressure medications, many of which are cheap as dirt, says Septimus. We can use them safely to reduce heart attack and stroke. Number 4, blood sugar. Doctors can measure blood sugar a few ways, but mostly rely on a hemoglobin A1C test. It's a little bit of a crude tool, and it doesn't tell the whole story, but it's usually the best number to go with, says Septimus. The test averages blood sugar over the past 2 to 3 months, and it usually diagnoses type 2 diabetes and prediabetes. You should get your A1C tested annually if you're over the age of 45, or if you're younger but are overweight and have risk factors like a sedentary lifestyle or a parent or a sibling with diabetes. People with diabetes usually test at least twice a year. And number 5, the basic metabolic rate, or the basal metabolic rate. Your BMR measures the minimum amount of energy your body needs to function at rest. It's the fuel your body burns just to stay alive every day, says Dr. Farhan Malik, medical director at Atlanta's Innovative Medicine Clinic. Knowing your BMR, he explains, allows you to determine if you're eating what you should to support your body's basic needs. That way, you can ensure changes to your diet and exercise routine are safe and sustainable. Using an online calculator to determine your BMR by plugging in your age, height, weight, and gender, your number will help you know what your body really requires to thrive every day. Next we have, good question. Are mosquitoes getting more dangerous? And this is by Alice Park. Mosquitoes seem to be everywhere this year, and they're not just a nuisance at outdoor gatherings. Health experts say they're carrying some serious diseases, a fact that's hitting home in the United States, as some towns in Massachusetts have shut down public parks and other outdoor areas in the evenings after the mosquitoes in the region were learned to be carrying Eastern equine encephalitis, a rare but deadly virus. And Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's former top infectious disease expert, was recently hospitalized with a West Nile virus infection he believed to have been acquired from a mosquito that was buzzing through his backyard. It's not news that mosquitoes carry a number of viruses and parasites that can be harmful to human health, including malaria, dengue, yellow fever, West Nile, and the Eastern equine encephalitis. And it's understood that different species of mosquitoes are adept at spreading different viruses. But is it actually a particularly bad year for the mosquito-borne disease? And what can we expect in the future? The variety primarily responsible for spreading Eastern equine encephalitis has drawn the most attention lately because of how dangerous and potentially deadly the disease is. But fewer than a handful of cases have been reported so far this year in the United States, which is pretty much on par with what's been reported in the New England area every year. And that's according to Dr. James Shepard, an infectious disease expert at Yale University School of Medicine. The more concerning type of mosquito is actually the most common, says Shepard. The Andeas mosquitoes, which include a variety of different species, cause most of the world's malaria, dengue, yellow fever, and Zika. They live primarily in urban, densely populated areas and can generate hundreds of eggs in as little as a capful of water. With an estimated 80% of people around the world now living in the urban settings, we're concentrating ourselves in much, much denser communities amongst urban mosquitoes, says Dr. Shepard. When it comes to West Nile virus, data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show that 38 states have reported more than 370 cases so far in 2024. Last year, more than 2,500 cases were recorded nationwide, nearly double the number that was reported in 2022. The experts note, however, that cases fluctuate depending on mosquito populations and the likelihood of human-mosquito interactions. But in general, the risk of such infections is likely to rise, since mosquito populations are growing. While it's true that so few mosquitoes are infected, the higher number of mosquitoes makes it much more likely that an encounter will happen, says Fotini Sinais, professor and deputy director of the Malaria Research Institute at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Mosquito populations are really climate and habitat driven, she says, and global warming is making it easier for mosquitoes to survive in much more parts of the world and for longer. The warmer planet also helps them to produce more generations of insects in a single season than ever before. With climate change, we see the habitat ranges for concerning species, like the Andeas, spreading northward, says Jonathan Oliver, associate professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. And all predictions indicate that they're going to spread throughout the southeast and up the eastern seaboard, and fairly high north into the Midwest. As mosquito species become established, people are potentially going to get exposed to a wide range of diseases that they carry. Take dengue, Zika, and West Nile virus, for example, says Dr. Shepard. that in the past decade or so, one of the species that carries these diseases now breeds year-round in Connecticut. We're going to see the march of these infections moving into more temperate zones in the United States, he says. Milder winters also mean that surviving mosquitoes can start reproducing earlier in the early spring rather than closer to summer, says Sinais. Each breeding cycle increases the population by tenfold, so by the time we get to summer, their populations have increased substantially. Warmer temperatures also affect how viruses survive and thrive inside the insect. If it's warmer, the virus reproduces faster inside the mosquito, says Oliver, and it reduces the window of time between the mosquito becoming infected and when it becomes infectious. Studies also show that mosquitoes can carry increasing infectiousness over the course of the season, which in turn raises the chances that they can bite and sicken people. Growing urbanization and densely packed cities with less than ideal sewage and sanitation system also provide more and fertile environments for mosquitoes to lay the eggs and proliferate. Around the world, urbanization is occurring in a very haphazard manner, says Dr. Shepherd. In many cases, it's not planned and there's no community development, so these cities are ringed by the vast shanty towns that are poorly served without water, sewage, and electricity. These, he says, are the perfect places for the infectious diseases to transmit. Another factor is likely fueling the rise of the mosquitoes. With increased urbanization comes the destruction of the natural landscape, which contributes to a drop in the biodiversity of species. The decrease of abundance of species is allowing expansion of infectious disease host species and their vectors, like mosquitoes, because they tend to be the most adaptable, says Shepherd. As other insect species are killed off, for example, he says more adaptable ones like the Aedeus may be filling the void and flourishing. So what's the best way to combat the growing assault from mosquitoes? Well, try to avoid coming into contact with them in the first place and lower your chances of getting bitten if you do. That means wearing long-sleeve clothing when outdoors and spraying yourself with insect repellent. You can also eliminate mosquito breeding grounds by getting rid of any standing water that's around your home. On a broader level, the researchers are working on ways to reduce mosquito population, including the traps that they attract to different mosquito species with different odors. The traps contain larvicides that destroy any egg mosquitoes may be laying, thus reducing the population. But developing the traps requires more detailed knowledge about the different species and how to attract them and is currently known, says Sinais. What we really like to do is to be able to predict when and where mosquito populations might be high. But we need to learn more about the habits of these specific mosquitoes and where they like to lay their eggs, she says. Some scientists are even turning to genetic modification to manipulate the mosquito populations. By introducing sterile males into a region, they could drastically reduce or even eliminate the future generations of any insects. But this is still being tested, as the researchers want to make sure that plummeting mosquito populations will not have more of a lasting or unintended ecological consequence. Another strategy that appears to be encouraging involves infecting mosquitoes with a bacterium that kills the virus that they may carry. It successfully reduced rates of dengue in Southeast Asia and Australia. More and more approaches are needed in order to fully understand and control the mosquitoes and the diseases that they carry, say the experts. If we're interested in addressing mosquito-borne diseases before they become really rampant, we need to devote more public health funding to mosquito surveillance, says Sinais. With climate change affecting so many species, including the mosquito, such knowledge is even more critical. Chances are the mosquito-borne illnesses are going to get worse, says Oliver, rather than better. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from Time Magazine, the September 30th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.